Welcome back to Dakota Midday from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. This American Life host Ira Glass describes the stories on the program as movies for radio. Each week, This American Life explores a theme through a mix of documentary, radio monologues, investigative journalism, and occasional fiction. This American Life made its debut in 1995 and has since become one of the most popular shows on public radio. Ira Glass is coming to Sioux Falls on Saturday evening for a presentation and Q&A, and I spoke with Ira Glass yesterday afternoon. Well, I'd just like to start off with going back to the early days of This American Life, wondering how long did it take for you and the program to find the voice, that the proper voice of This American Life that we know today?
I mean, it definitely evolved over time. At the beginning, all the old episodes are up on the internet. And if you listen to the early episodes, you can recognize it as the same show, but it's like the early episodes of The Simpsons or something where the characters just look a little off. And at the beginning, there were way more weird things that we would try. Like we had performance artists do pieces, and we had way artsier stuff sometimes. And as the show evolved, there were structural things that we added, like we were probably 6 months in or 8 months in before I came up with the idea of calling it Act One, Act Two, Act Three, in between the different stories. And then there were content things which changed. And the main one is that over time, I and the producers on the show became much more interested in doing documentary-ish stories. And at the beginning, it's way more of a mix of artists and fiction writers and humorists like David Sedaris doing stories and mixed with documentary stories and interviews. So over time, I feel like the outside writers phased out, and the fiction pieces phased out, and the performance artists phased out, and not for any reason other than the staff and I felt like we just enjoyed doing the other stuff more.
There's still that degree of experimentation, though, isn't there?
There is experimentation, but it's experimentation as documentary producers. So we'll do things like we'll take on a subject that we've never taken on before and try to do it in a way that no one has done it. So we'll decide that we'll document one holiday weekend at a rest stop on the side of the highway or one car dealership in Long Island in 1 month as they try to make their goal of 129 cars, or it'll be a whole show of coincidences, or it'll be a show where each of us has to do a story that our parents pitched, like one of the bad or not professional story ideas anyway, that our parents will say, like, why did you do a story on? And then we thought, like, well, let's actually do a show where we make those stories, and try to make them good. And so there's a lot of experimentation like that. And then there's experimentation in terms of just trying to go in and document things that other people haven't documented. Like we sent three reporters for 5 months to a high school where there were 29 kids shot in 1 year and just put on a sort of hardcore documentary production to that sort of thing.
In some of the pieces, the stories, I'm wondering, as you're putting together This American Life, if you have the theme first or you have the stories and realize, oh, this story and this story and this story will work on this theme?
Generally, it's somewhere in between. And what will happen is we have one story we know we like and we have nothing to go with it, of all the things that we're considering doing it. But we'll think, like, this story is great and could be an anchor for a new show. And then we'll just concoct what could the theme possibly be. Like right now we have a story, this incredibly beautiful story that one of our producers, Nancy Updike, is doing at this hospice where she goes to this hospice for several weeks and observes what happens there. And we're like, well, should it be a whole show about death? No, that would be kind of a downer, that we have stories that we could fill with that. And then we're like, well, should we do a show on death and birth? And then we're like, no, that's a little corny, though we have stories that we could fill that out with. And then for a while we were like, let's just do a show on death and taxes. And then we started looking around for taxes stories. And it turns out that I know that this would be a shock, but we couldn't find that many fascinating accounting stories to do.
Yeah.
And then we're thinking about calling it The Inevitable. And so we have a story at the DMV, and we have a small story about taxes, and we have the story about death, and we have a story, so generally what will happen is we have a story that we love, and then we try to invent something that we think will work as a theme.
How often do you have stories that you think, oh, this is a perfect story, this is going to be great, I can't wait to get it on the radio, put this together, and then you're in the editing process and it's just not working?
It happens more that it dies in the interviewing process, in the tape gathering process. Like for us to get enough stories that we think are good enough to put into a show, it often takes us 3 or 4 or 5 months. And we'll often look at 15 or 20 or 25 stories and go into production, you know, like fly people around the country and you know, commission writers and things like that, for like 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, often 7 or 8 stories. And then only the best 3 or 4 end up on the air. And usually what happens is we go out and we do the interviews and we realize like, oh, this isn't going to work. Like usually it doesn't get to the editing process. But when it does get to the editing, but sometimes it does, and we'll make the story. We'll actually make a draft. And sometimes we'll do a draft and a redraft and a redraft and a redraft. And then we just decide like, okay, there's no way to save this, and we kill it. Like that definitely happens probably once every 3 months.
For as long as you've been doing This American Life, have you gotten to the point where you know what will work? I mean, is it more common that you know the building blocks of what's going to make a good story, one that will really grab the listener?
I mean, sadly, because what we're doing, or maybe fantastically, because what we're doing depends on the interviewees being interesting, we never know what's going to work until we start to do it. I mean, we know what seems like it could work if the people were good, but until we get out there and do the interviews, we don't know. And often, like, the problem is, like, actually getting people to agree to an interview. Like, there's a story that I'm trying to do in Atlanta, and I flew down there yesterday and tried to get these people to talk to me, and I could just not get these two teachers to talk to me. And one of them, like, literally got thrown off her lawn by members of her family and just, like, get out. And I was like, I'm not trying to make this lady look bad. In fact, she's the hero of the story. And they're like, we don't care, get out. And then the other teacher, I just cannot get her to answer my phone calls, you know. And just like, it's just, and I went to her house and she wasn't at her house, and I don't know. And this story is such an obvious story. Like if we could get the story, if we can get the people to talk to us, and if they're good talkers, it's such an amazing story. It's such a naturally cinematic story. Like it's people in a very dramatic situation, and they decide to. It's teachers who decide basically there's something wrong going on at their school. There's a cheating scandal, and they wear a wire for the authorities, and you know, like basically they basically implicate their own friends and coworkers. You know, like nice little third grade teachers and stuff. And so it's very, very dramatic and life changing for the people involved. And like, if we could just get the people to tell us the story. So this is an example of like, it's a perfect story. It's really a perfect story for the radio, if only I can get the people to talk to me.
What's fascinating about This American Life is really what we're hearing is just voices mixed with music, but yet they're so powerful. And I can think of some of these stories that stick with me so many years later, and I don't know why. For example, this might have been from the early days, a story of a guy talking about his dad who quit his job and started dumpster diving to feed his family. And then you mentioned the Weekend at the Rest Area, another show that just still sticks with me. And I'm wondering what it is about, if it's the stories or the way they're told, the medium of radio, what is it that makes them so memorable?
I mean, I think it's a mix of the people that we look for are relatable people, and the situations that they're in are surprising, but they're situations that, because of the way they tell the story, it's possible to imagine it happening to you. And then radio itself, I think, is just an incredible medium for telling a story. Like, I think the fact that you don't see people and that it's just somebody's voice and you can hear the emotion in someone's voice, I think actually pictures can get in the way of relating to people in a story. And the fact that you don't see them actually makes it penetrate more, makes it more emotional, makes it easier to relate to, makes it more universal.
You mentioned not seeing the person you're hearing on the radio, and it's interesting because Ira Glass, you're going to be on stage at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls on Saturday, and we hear your voice. We don't see you, but there you're going to be on stage. As the host of the program, is that an odd situation then to then be standing in front of all these people that know you, your voice, and now they're going to see the words coming out of your mouth?
Yeah, I mean, for the first minute of it, it definitely is a little weird for the audience, and I can feel that it's weird for the audience from the stage. And there's a feeling of like, wait, that's who you are? And even I think if you've seen a picture of somebody on the radio, actually like seeing their voice come out of their mouth, it's just like, it's weird. It's uncanny. It's not entirely pleasant. But then hopefully people get over it and it's fine. And then for me, honestly, it's nice to be in front of a real audience. I mean, I didn't ever do any public speaking. Like most people, I had a tremendous, aversion to public speaking, before I started it. And then to promote the radio show, I'll go out and give talks like the one I'm giving there. And now I'm very used to it, and it's really fun to be in front of an audience. In a way, it's more fun to be on stage talking to people than to be on the radio, we'll do stuff on the show, and I feel like, well, I hope that's funny. Like, I think that's funny. But, there's nobody there in the room laughing or anything, And so to be in a room where, if you say something and people laugh, it's gratifying, and it feels like an actual communicative act instead of the weird simulacrum of a communicative act, which is what it's like to sit in a completely soundproof room and talk into a microphone and pretend that there's people on the other side hearing your voice.
We're talking about radio, and you mentioned the unique power of the medium. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the future of radio as we're dealing in this world where there's mobile and online listening. If that is changing the way that we listen to radio, or if radio even has a future, the terrestrial radio that we know so well.
I mean, people have been predicting the death of radio for a really long time, but I think as long as there are radios in cars and as long as all of us are lazy, there's still a place for people to just think, like, you just don't want to have to program every single thing, that you listen to. And there was a fear when the internet became a medium with which you could download sound that people would stop listening to radio and would just download a playlist of what they want to hear. But I think most of us, we get up in the morning, we want to drive to work, and you don't want to have to do the work of that. And so it's so much nicer to be able to turn on Morning Edition or whatever you happen to listen to. And so I think, radio is here to stay for that reason. And what the internet has done is, I think, helped a lot of people get to shows that they wouldn't have otherwise heard or would be missing each week. And in the case of our show, it's been just a huge, boom. Our audience has stayed the same size roughly for the last decade, and on the radio, and we've added like a million people who download the show each week as a podcast. And so right now, we have 2 million people listening on the radio and 1 million people listening on podcast. And so that's just that just wouldn't have happened any other way. And those people are all over the world, and it's just an amazing gift.
I read an interview with you recently, and you were asked the question, what your favorite part of working on This American Life, what that favorite part is, and surprised, I guess, to read that it's the editing process, that you don't really care that much about actually hosting the show.
Yes. I mean, it's not that I don't care about it. I try to do a nice job, but it's not the fun part of the week. And the part of being on the radio that I like is making stories, and most of making a story is editing and re-editing and re-editing it, and trying to make it better and trying to make the plot points stronger and trying to take out the fat and just try to make the thing really compelling. Like, that's super fun to me. And it's the only part of doing my job that I had a natural talent for. Every other part, like learning how to find a story, learning how to write a story, learning how to read on the radio or perform on the radio. That took me a long time. But the editing stuff always, it's the part that I liked from the beginning and felt like I could do. And I was a behind the scenes person for the first decade. I worked at NPR in Washington. I was a production assistant and associate producer and newscast writer, and I did all the backstage kinds of jobs. And only after about 11 years of doing that did I start to go on the air myself. And I was not so great, and I had to train myself to be able to perform in a way that it would be okay to listen to. And still, every week when I sit down to actually like perform my part of the show, it's the part I dread the most. And I feel like all you can do is screw it up. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like, because I know the script is really strong, but if I perform it wrong, you could try to oversell stuff. You know, you can sound fake. You can sound like a phony. Like if you sell it wrong in the performance, then it kind of ruins the story. So if everything goes great, what happens is that nobody notices you reading it or telling it. And if you do it badly, it just kind of ruins it. So all you can do when you sit down, if you do your very best job, it'll just be fine. And if you do a bad job, you actually will ruin the story. And so it's just like, I always feel like it's such a threatening moment, and it's such a moment where like things can go very, very badly.
Does that happen that often though? That you feel like you didn't quite do the intro, introduce the story, read the script quite as well as it was written?
Yeah, it totally happens. Yeah, happens. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would say that every couple of weeks I hear myself, like when I listen to the show, I'll hear it. I'll go, like, oh, what is wrong with you? Why did you think you should be on the radio?
That's probably something that all of us who do this, we all feel that.
Not Garrison Keillor, man.
Not Garrison Keillor. Well, I do, and I guess you do. Ira Glass, yeah. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday, and safe travels, and we look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
I look forward to coming out there.